One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priests of Midian had several daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Thank you, Laurel. Hearing you sing is just, I don't know if all of you can hear all of you the way I hear you, but hearing you sing about the gospel of Jesus and what he has done for you and what he is doing in you right now, man, it's just, it's so life-giving. The gathered church matters. It really does matter to be with God's people and hear someone else, because you may have had a hard week. You may have received that phone call this week and that diagnosis or that thing that you didn't want to happen to your family. And sometimes the word of the gospel is stronger in our brothers and sisters than it is in us. And it's okay to admit that and to be like lifted up and strengthened and buoyed by the voices and the hearts of the saints. So I love that, yeah, part of the service this morning, just singing and hearing you sing. And so about a decade ago, and some of you may remember this, the American Film Institute came out with their top 100 list. Some of you remember this? Top 100 films in American filmmaking. And they, as part of their celebration of their anniversary, they published a top 100 film list, top 100 one-liners, top 100 heroes and villains. And that was split into two groups, 50 and 50. So the top 50 heroes in film history in America, it's a great list. You would know most of them. But the number one hero is not the person I expected. Who do you think the number one hero on American film? Yeah, so let me give you the definition of hero first, and then you can kind of let this help you. They defined a hero as a character who prevails in extreme circumstances, who dramatizes a sense of morality, courage, and purpose. Morality is just a big word for what's right and wrong to do at any given moment. But this hero, he embodies morality, courage, and purpose. Though he or she may be ambiguous or flawed, they often sacrifice themselves to show humanity at its best. That sounds right, right? Like that's what a hero Does that sound right? Courage, sacrifice, humanity, embodying things that would help us to see. That's who we need to rescue us. That's who we want to be when we grow up. That's what a hero is. So I was surprised when I saw the list. It was not Batman. Where's Jacob? It was not Batman. Batman was like 46. It was not Wonder Woman. It was not Wyatt Earp. It was not Maximus. It was not Rocky. It wasn't even Bond, James Bond. It wasn't even James Bond. Are you ready for this? It was Atticus Finch, 1962, To Kill a Mockingbird, Gregory Peck. If you haven't seen that in a while, you should go back and watch it, because Peck crushes it in the movie. He's excellent. Now, some of you are going to be like, I can't watch an old black and white movie. It's just too slow. But you need to let the slowness work for you and get you to this moment in the movie where this guy is absolutely heroic. And he stands before the mob to protect an innocent black man who's been accused wrongly of rape in the prejudiced, hateful, ugly white South of the 1930s. And he does stand up, and he is heroic, and it's powerful, and he's got this beautiful mix of strength and honor and gentleness and rightness. Look, we live in a world. Here's why we love heroes. This is why you love Marvel. This is why you love John Wayne. Doesn't matter. Because we live in a world full of injustice and hate. And we ourselves have been convicted on more than one occasion of the hate that lives inside of us. And we long for someone to come and make all wrongs right. Like, it's in us. It is in us to feel this sense of the need for a hero. If you're visiting with us for the first time this Sunday, or maybe you just dropped back in, we are studying the book of Exodus, and we're looking at the life of Moses. And what we're learning from the life of Moses is incredibly compelling, and in fact, it's a hero story. This is a hero story. Everything's pointing us in that direction. Right, like right now, is where we are in Exodus is moving us toward Moses. Is he the hero of Israel? I mean, he's conceived by parents who shouldn't even have a child in this season of threat and instability. And then so he's conceived by faith. He's born under a sentence of death, and yet God's hands protect him in this tiny little ark that's floating on the Nile for however long. And then he's adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, showing him compassion and kindness she should not be showing him. And then raised, trained by the best in Egypt. I mean, the makings of this guy is going to rise up and be a hero. Surely he is Israel's hero. Surely he's going to be the hero of Israel. Everything points to it. He's got to be the chosen one. I want to show you three things from the life of Moses that I hope will strengthen your faith. Strengthen your faith, deepen your love for God, maybe even awaken something inside of you that has been dormant for a while. Number one, here are three things. Number one, Moses loves God's people. Verse 11. One day, so look with me if you would. This is on page 45 in the Pew Bible. I'd love for you to see this with your own eyes and hear it as we read it together. Verse 11, one day when Moses had grown up, Moses' life is seen. We learn this from the New Testament in 40-year segments, right? So 0 to 40, he's in Egypt. 40 to 80, we're about to see what happens. That 80 to 120, that last segment, is the third part of his life. He one day has, verse 11 indicates that he's now in his adult years, and according to the book of Acts, Stephen says, when he was 40 years old, this is when this happened. So when he had grown up means he is a fully formed adult. He's a 40-year-old man. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked upon their burdens. He looked with emotion and compassion upon them. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Verse 11 wants to emphasize the dignity and the humanity of the children of Israel. And Moses has this sense of solidarity that he feels with them. You'll notice it says twice, his people. Do you see that in the text? His people. At the first part, he went out to see his people, and then one of his people. So the text wants to emphasize the importance of the dignity and humanity of the people of God, the people of Israel. And we don't know when this happened, but at some point, something changed for Moses. Because he'd been trained his whole life to look down on these people. It was nothing for him to see them as lower than him. He'd been trained that way, he thought that way, he lived that way. But something changed. We don't know how long this compassion had been growing inside of him. We don't know how long this solidarity with these people was real to him, and we don't know how either. Maybe his mom, adoptive mother, Pharaoh's daughter, maybe she told him one day, I need to tell you something, Moses. Or maybe he had, Jesus heard people whispering in the palace. He's not really an Egyptian. He's not an Egyptian. Watch him. He's a Hebrew. Or, we don't know, maybe he just had this sneaking suspicion, I am different. I don't know. We don't know how it happens, but at some point, there's this change that occurs. And what we do know is this, that according to Stephen's sermon in the book of Acts, Moses, when he is 40 years old, about 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, to visit Israel, to go out to them, right? So that's what verse 11 says. He went out to them to be among them, to see them and visit the labor camps and however it unfolded. I love that expression in Acts chapter 7. One day it came into his heart. This is Stephen's way of describing what happened in Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. One day, it came into his heart. Something happened to him. He went out and Moses saw what he had seen 1,000 times before. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And he'd been able to walk away from it so many other times, right? But he couldn't on this day. Because it came into his heart. It's like a dam broke and a flood, a lifetime of seeing the accumulated pain and suffering of God's people just overcame him, and he couldn't walk away from it anymore. Maybe he tried to walk away. But he couldn't. It came with him. Their burdens, it says. Their burdens came with him. The shame, the prejudice, the physical pain, the solidarity that was growing inside of him. There was no turning back. So something happened to him. I'm going to call it some kind of gospel reversal. There's a gospel reversal that began to shift inside of him. We know this because Hebrews chapter 11 in the New Testament says this. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter any longer, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. I'm calling attention to verse 26 on the screen. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. At some point, Moses grew up. And he grew up spiritually, and he grew up in his humanity, and he grew up in his sense of justice, and he grew up, and it's like, I'm tired of helping the rich people get richer. Like, that's not the way I'm going to live my life. I'm tired of watching the powerful people just get more and more power. I'm not going to live that way anymore. I'm going to look to God. I'm going to be changed by God. And he was. And he treasured Christ more than all the wealth and power and fame and security of Egypt. Now, that would be a very hard thing to walk away from, don't you think? I mean, don't be super spiritual with me right now. Like, wouldn't it be hard to walk away from all of the security and power and success and Egypt was the place to live. They had everything. Why would you do that? Something happened inside of him. Moses experienced gospel change. Moses was powerfully changed by God, and it awakened in him a sense of compassion and justice and all these things we've already said. All right, so Moses loves God's people, and he loves God's people enough to really start to see with clarity what matters most in life. And he does. And so right now, he's on the hero track. This sounds good, right? This sounds like we're heading in the right, like he's tracking to be, surely he's the hero of Israel. Verse 12. Well, not so fast, right? Because Moses is deeply flawed. The same day that compassion came into his heart, something impulsive, unrestrained, and even hateful came out of his heart. What did he do in verse 12? When he saw this Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, he looked this way and that and see no one. He struck him down. We don't know if he intended to murder him. We don't know. It certainly doesn't seem to be premeditated murder, but he definitely kills him and he hides him in the sand. Moses has this holy zeal. He wants to do something for God, but it is a zeal. It's a zeal without wisdom. And it's impulsive. And he took matters into his own hands. And he's going to save God's people his own way. I mean, he's on the vigilante track right now. He's going to do this. And yet God's not ready for him to do this. Have you ever found yourself just deeply convicted about something, but then you ran ahead of God anyway to execute it? Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me. Like, 100% sure this is the right thing to do, and then we do it the wrong way. That can happen. And that's what happened to Moses. He had the right idea. I mean, someone needed to step in between this Egyptian taskmaster and this innocent Hebrew who's been beaten again and again and again. There is, though, something missing in Moses' response. And I think we might call it an attendant mercy, like a mercy that is present, a mercy that's governing, a mercy that is controlling and restraining. And Moses did not have that. Moses, like you and I, is just deeply flawed. Some scholars have tried to justify Moses' killing and not call it murder, but I think it's pretty clear from the text itself that this is wrong. What he does is wrong. Do you see any clues in verse 12? What are some clues in verse 12 that this is not the right thing for Moses to have done, the way he did it? Well, the first clue is right there in verse 12. He looked this way and that. Do you remember the last time you were trying to make that traffic light? And you saw it go from green to yellow. You're like, I'm good. But then you also looked this way and that. Like, I just want to make sure there's no Roanoke County police officers who I deeply respect. And you went through the light anyway. So looked this way and that is a clue toward culpability. Right? There's a second clue. He did what with the body? What did he do with the body? He hid the evidence. Now, last time I checked, when I'm right about something, I want the evidence to come to the center of the courtroom. Right? If you're right about something, you're not afraid for the evidence to come out. But he buried, like Moses feels, this is all happening very quickly for him, and this, we hear this in testimonies of people, it all just happened so fast, and I shouldn't have. And then he buried the body. There's a third clue. Drop down to verse 14. Later, when he breaks up the fight between the two Hebrews, they push back, and what do they say to him? Are you going to kill us too? And Moses, it says, was afraid. Do you see that? He was afraid. He had been found out. That's another significant indication to us, right? Why be afraid? Why be afraid? Why not say, look, I had every right to bring justice in this moment. Why not say that? Well, because Moses went too far. And he took a life. Guilty life? Yeah, a guilty life. But he took the life. And he went too far, too fast. There's one final reason we see this as murder and not as a justified killing, and that is that if you know the story of Moses and the life of Moses, you'll be anticipating this. This marks the turning point in the narrative, and God is going to take him into the wilderness from here. God's going to take him into the wilderness for 40 years. And he does that because Moses is not ready, because something needs to change. Yeah, this gospel reversal has begun, but something deeper needs to happen to Moses. That's the way we interpret this. So, off to the wilderness we go. Point number three. Moses is not yet ready. Moses loves God's people, right? There's truth and grace that has awakened in him. He's got a deep sense of identity and solidarity with God's people, and yet he's deeply flawed, and he moves ahead of God. He makes a significant mistake. He's just not ready. This point is solidified for us in Acts chapter 7. You don't have to turn there, but listen to the language of Acts chapter 7. We learn from there that Moses presumed upon his own readiness. The language is assumption, presuming. He expected his Hebrew brothers, he expected the slaves of Israel to embrace him as a peacemaker, to embrace him as their deliverer, to embrace him as the one who would come, and to embrace him as hero. Like he presumed upon them, the text says. That's really insightful for us. That's really important. He thought he was ready. He thought salvation was coming to them by his hand. That's what it says in Acts chapter 7, verse 25. Moses thought God would bring salvation to Israel by his own hand. And I take that to mean Moses is not quite ready for God and God's hand to be the one that leads them out through Moses. There's a big difference between really letting God lead you and seeing yourself in some sort of righteous vigilante effort to make things right now. He thought he was ready. He was not ready. God's people were not ready. And that brings us to verses 15 through 22. I'll pick up in verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. From your perspective, Egypt would be here. and Canaan over here, and Midian way down here. So Moses goes as far away as he possibly can, you know, within reason, and he's running. He's going into the wilderness, and he stops by a well. He's no doubt stopped at several other places to get water and food, but now he stops in a more permanent way in verse 15, and he sits down by a well. And the priest, this is verse 16, pick up with me in verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to that well to draw water. And they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, and this apparently was a recurring problem, right? But Moses stood up and saved them, and he watered the flock. I mean, this is like, says there's several shepherds. Moses was a dude. Moses is like, no, these ladies are going to get to do this. So he saves them. When they came home, they said, you're not going to believe this. Because their father's like, why are you home so early? It doesn't normally happen this way. They said, well, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds. They think he's an Egyptian. They think Moses is an Egyptian. And he delivered us and even drew water for us and watered the flock. Well, bring him to us. Let's feed the guy. Bring him home. Let me meet this guy. 21. And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And that man, Reuel, also known as Jethro, later, gave Moses his daughter, Zipporah. And she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom. And this is really important, because the Hebrew people would name their children in light of God's providence and care and sovereignty in that particular season of life. So Moses names this son Gershom because he says, I am a sojourner in a foreign land. This hero in the making is aware that he has no people to save right now. He is a sojourner. Like, he's discovered who his people are. These are my people. I identify with them. I know them. This is my story. These are my people. We are God's people. And yet, I am not with them right now. I'm disconnected from them. I'm a sojourner. I'm in a wasteland. I have no one to give this leadership that I thought God was about to use me to do. So Moses is now a hero with no one to save. And yet, look at verse 17. Yet verse 17 and verse 19 both keep the language of saving and deliverance on the table in front of us. Sort of just a reminder. This man, he is going to save, deliver, and lead them out of Egypt, but he's not quite there yet. He's going to need some time in the wilderness. God is going to use Moses, but he's going to need time in the wilderness first. This is one of the hardest thoughts that you will ever process as a Christian. I hope you are starting to think about it. God is doing something, and he's doing it when he takes me into the wilderness. The wilderness is a significant biblical theme for spiritual formation, for growing up. Growing up in Christ. No one wants to go to the wilderness. Some of you have had some fairly easy, simple lives. Some of you have had some really hard lives. The Christian life is described as a life that really must go through the wilderness. If it's been easy for you so far, don't be surprised when it gets hard as a believer. I mean, let that collide with our sort of modern. I mean, it's so hard these days. We are so modernized and designer and customized. Like, my designer customized life that drives through the Chick-fil-A drive-thru, and I come out and I don't have exactly what I need to get, and I like to talk to a manager because I didn't get exactly what I need to get. I mean, what are we doing? It's crazy. We should expect that God is going to rock our designer lives, our customized, organized lives. The wilderness is a recurring theme. Don't be surprised when everything doesn't work out perfectly for you. Stop believing this sort of pseudo-prosperity gospel out there that makes you think that everything should just be easy. This is a broken, fallen world. This is a dark, evil world. We are broken, fallen creatures. The wilderness is real. And God, in His amazing grace, it is worth observing that this very thing happens to Jesus, the sinless Son of God, that the Spirit leads Him into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights to tempt and try and test to prepare. Not because He was sinful, but because God wanted to ready Him and prepare Him for His life and ministry and for the cross. If the Son of God was led into the wilderness by the Spirit for 40 days and 40 nights, you and I should be less surprised when things don't go exactly like we want them to go. We should see value. And I am not praying. Man, if you pray for suffering, if you pray for wilderness, there's something really wrong with you. I'm not saying that. Okay, please don't misunderstand me this morning. And you shouldn't pray for anybody else. But it is part of the Christian life to find yourself in the wilderness. And can we just be honest for a minute? Not everything is the wilderness. Simple inconveniences are not the wilderness. Are you with me? The wilderness sounds more like, why did my dad do that to me and physically abuse me and leave my family, and I've never seen him again? And now I don't even know how to think about God the Father. 30 years of wilderness. That's wilderness. Or long-term suffering with a debilitating disease. How come I can't do what everyone else can do? That's wilderness. Simple inconveniences, like the preacher went 7 minutes over today. I mean, I should probably target for that now. That's not wilderness. Are you with me? That's not wilderness. Do you remember Numbers chapter 12? This is said of Moses. Moses was this strong man. He was certain and confident, and apparently had some temper and impulse to him. But by the time you meet him in Numbers chapter 12, it says this. The Bible says that Moses had become one of the meekest. It says he's the meekest man on the planet. Moses was gentle and strong. But it took 40 years, I suppose, in the wilderness to be emptied of himself and to get a sense of true humility. Does that ever strike you? Like, where did that come from? Where did this expression about Moses, that he was the meekest man on the planet, like Miriam and Aaron are in this conversation, and it's said of Moses, among all the people of influence in Israel, that he was the most humble. Where would that have come from? It would come from the wilderness. It would come from 40 years of maturity and formation and deep humility uniquely combined with a leadership strength. It certainly didn't come from watching Pharaoh in his early years. Let me close with verses 23 and 24. I want to close with who the real hero of Israel. Who do you think the real hero? Who's the real hero? Yeah. God is the real hero of Egypt, of Israel. God is the real hero. Look at verse 23. During those many days, the king of Egypt died. Oh, when Israel found out about that, there was a sense of amazing relief. The king of Egypt, Pharaoh, died. Maybe something's going to change for us. And they cried out to God. The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. And their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. That is, God heard their cry. Notice that they did not do this. They did not say to themselves, okay, we have been resigned to exist. Like, we're servants, we're slaves. It's going to be like this for the rest of our lives. I mean, they could have very easily said, well, the next Pharaoh is going to be just like this Pharaoh, and we're going to live as slaves in Egypt for the rest of our lives. Y'all might as well just get used to it. I'm sure there was some of that going around. But that's not what they do as a people. What they do as a people is they cry out to God. Note to self, when you feel like you are resigned to a servitude, when you are enslaved in sin and your life is enslaved in bondage and you just don't know how, if ever, you could get out and you want to give up, like when you want to give up and just resign yourself that this is just the way it's going to be, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't try to save yourself. Do something else. Cry out to God. This is what the scriptures say. They cried out to God, and their cry came up to the Lord, and the Lord heard their cry. There are four statements I want you to mark or note. God heard, God remembered, God saw, and God knew. The emphasis in these last two verses, and this is sort of like a transitional paragraph. It's not a long one, but it's a transitional statement. And these will be woven throughout the story of Exodus, and you're going to see them pop up here and there. This is one of them, and it's designed to put God at the center of the story. God heard. God remembered. He heard their cries and their prayers. He remembered his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw every beating. God saw every spit in the face. God saw every dehumanizing act of Egypt against his people. And God knew. God knew. Not just informationally, of course God knows. God knows everything. God's omniscient. No, that's not what it means. It means God knew, like relationally knew. He felt it. He heard their cry. So I don't know where you are today, but some of you might be tempted to give up. You might be like, I guess it's just going to be the way that it is. And you've just sort of resigned yourself to, maybe you've just resigned yourself to an alcohol addiction. Or to a pornography addiction, or to a gambling addiction, or to just worrying all the time. I'm just a worrier. That's just what I do. I just worry. Whatever the thing is, and yeah, you know what it is. Whatever the thing is, you're going to be tempted just to say, like, this is just the way it is. Don't do that. Don't do that. If you will cry out to God, if you will pray, if you will surrender, if you will cry out to the Lord, and you will say, God, please help me, I am so confident that He will hear you. Now, he might not fix it tomorrow, but I'm so confident that he is at work. And you know why? My confidence comes from Hebrews chapter 5, where the Bible says that Jesus cried out to God. Jesus, the Son of God. Jesus cried out to God. It says, with loud cries and tears, he prayed on the cross, Father, save me. And the Father did save him. He died. He was buried. He rose. Like, the resurrection of Jesus is the exclamation point that God saves. And if he did that for Jesus, who died in your place to make your cries meaningful, to make your hopelessness hopeful, he wants to do that in your life through Christ. So I'm certain that he will hear your cry because he heard the cry of Jesus for you already on the cross. This is what we believe. Christianity teaches that Jesus came and lived a sinless, perfect life and endured suffering and endured seasons in the wilderness for us. And he's the true Moses. He's the true and greater Moses who leads us out of bondage. And it's our condition, our fallen condition, that constantly wants to go back to Egypt and find security there and think this is, you know, we're just going to be like this. We're just going to be stuck for the rest of our lives. You don't have to be stuck for the rest of your life. You can find freedom and hope and new life in the one who cried out for you. Jesus. Do you have a hero? Do some of you have like a real hero that you think about all the time? You should have a hero. You should have a bona fide hero. And I'm not talking about Captain America. I could do this all day. I'm not talking about that. I'm not even talking about Atticus Finch. You need a real eternal hero. So I want to pray this morning that we would start seeing Jesus. What would it be like if this room was full of people who started seeing Jesus Christ, the risen Son of God, as their personal hero? And I'm not saying you go get a t-shirt and a bumper sticker that say Jesus is my hero. Don't do that. You can if you want to. But I'm just saying, live like you're living for someone more who has saved you and is your greatest treasure. And you're like, he's going to save the day. Today stinks. I almost said the other word, but today stinks. But I got a hero. He's going to save the day. He's not just going to save today. He's going to save the whole thing. Let's pray.